and welcome to Diversity Ever After, a Baker Donaldson D&I podcast. We are professionals focused on creating an honest and accepting space for ourselves, our community, and our listeners. Here at Diversity Ever After, we raise awareness of D&I workplace and social issues, we advocate for increased representation and inclusion, and we navigate uncomfortable but necessary conversations. Inclusion starts with I, so we invite you to listen and become in touch, in tune, and inclusive.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Diversity Ever After. We are in season 4 of our podcast. We are quickly becoming veterans in the game. I'm excited to return as a host of this episode with a guest that is so close to my heart. Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals is joining us today to talk about the meaning of the historic appointment and confirmation of the first Black woman to the United States Supreme Court, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Before we dive into this exciting topic, let's do introductions. My name is Bahati Mutisia. I am a health law regulatory attorney in Baker Donaldson's North Carolina office.
And I am Nikimalee Davis Primer, a shareholder in the firm's Jackson, Mississippi office. My practice is primarily labor and employment.
And I now have the pleasure of introducing Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby was sworn in as Chief Judge of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals on March 17th of 2017. Prior to being designated Chief Judge, she was nominated by President George W. Bush in August of 2006 to serve as an Associate Judge of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. Before that, Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby, nominated by President Bill Clinton, served as an Associate Judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia from 2000 to 2006. And she served as a magistrate judge on the Superior Court of the District of Columbia from 1995 to 2000. Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby graduated from Duke University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science, and she earned her law degree from the Howard University School of Law, graduating in the top 5% of her class. Following law school, Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby was an associate at the law firm currently known as Hogan Lovells, and later joined what is now called the District of Columbia Office of Attorney General, where she served as special counsel to the Corporation Counsel. In addition to her busy role as chief, she is an adjunct professor, and she has held offices in several judicial organizations. And I'm personally proud to say that I am a former law clerk of Chief Judge Blackburn Rigsby. My first job out of law school was working in her chambers, so everyone who's seen my great work today can thank you, Judge Blackburn Rigsby, for the wonderful training that kickstarted my legal career. You have been not only an excellent role model for me professionally, but you have also been a personal mentor of mine. So thank you very much for that. And I am thrilled to have you with us today.
Wow. I am so happy to be here. And Bahati, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be a part of the firm's podcast series. I think it's a phenomenal idea. And Nikimalee, it's a pleasure to meet you. And Bahati, I just have to say, I'm always so proud to see you and to keep up with your wonderful career.
Well, thank you very much. Let's dive in. We have an exciting topic to discuss today. We wanted to have an episode where we could discuss the historical event with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson being her ascension to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we thought of you for this podcast, not only because you are a Black woman who is a judge on an appellate court in this country, but also because in 2010, you authored a law review article for Howard's Law Journal, and it was titled Black Women Judges, The Historical Journey of Black Women to the Nation's Highest Courts. So in that article, you talked about the importance of diversity on appellate courts. So for our listeners, can you share what do you think are the benefits of diversity, and why is it important that we strive for diversity on appellate courts?
First of all, I think diversity is important on all of our courts and in the judiciary in particular, as well as across our society. And I think it's critical in a democratic society, that we hear and allow and give voice to diverse viewpoints because we are a diverse country. But when we talk about the judiciary in particular, public trust and confidence in the legal justice system is so important. And for the appellate courts in particular, diversity has a very special and critical role. I think sometimes people are not always aware that when you go into an appellate court, you're typically going to have your case heard by a panel of judges. That's different from what most people experience when they go to the trial court, where they have one judge and sometimes a jury, if it's a jury trial. So what that means is when parties come to our Court of Appeals, and in the District of Columbia, our Court of Appeals is the highest local court. So it would be the equivalent of the North Carolina Supreme Court or the Mississippi Supreme Court. And it's the last resort for most people who have matters that have come before the courts in the District of Columbia. And what we do is we hear the cases and decide whether or not the decision below should be reversed or whether it was the correct decision and should be affirmed. And we decide cases in panels. That's the point I'm getting to. So typically there'll be three judges on a panel, but sometimes it's all nine judges on our court when we sit together en banc. And so deciding things collegially, collectively, is a very different process than as a single trial judge when you make the decision and you see whether or not it's appealed. And I think diversity of viewpoints, diversity of experiences, professional and personal, are really important when we're having that discussion about how to interpret the facts and apply the law to the facts in a particular case. Does that always mean that a decision will end up differently because the panel is diverse? Not necessarily, but I like to think there will be a much richer discussion and deliberation and a more nuanced opinion decision that comes when you have different voices at the table. And you know, one example is if everybody who sat on a particular case all came from the same law firm and the same practice group at a law firm, they might view the facts and the law in a particular way. If everybody on the panel, all the judges were former prosecutors, they may view the case a certain way. If all the judges were former public defenders, they might view the case from through a certain lens when you apply the law to the facts. And I think when you get a mix, you get a richer and fuller discussion that I think enhances the law.
I think that is such a great point, because in your article, you noted that increase in diversity does not guarantee that the cases will be decided differently, like you just said, but the legal discourse will be more varied in determining how those laws impact the daily realities of people's lives. And when you have an appellate court with different perspectives and life experiences, it most certainly helps enrichen that discussion because people will see it through their lens. I love that you use that term, because Annalise Quinn had this quote that I often cite is, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. And that's right. Really because we're seeing things through our lived experiences. And of course, judges are impartial and fair, but you still have lived life. And you'll see and pick up on things based on your working experiences and other different things that you've done over the course of your careers. And that truly adds that extra public trust that you were talking right. about to the equation, because the people can then see, oh, the people deciding my case, they get it. You know, they're talking about the things that are important to me. They're not overlooking key points of how this will actually impact my life, which I think is something that sometimes appellate court judges or any judges can overlook. Like, what is the practical implication of this decision on the people that will be impacted?
No, I agree with that. And I think, for example, I came to the Court of Appeals having served on our trial court for 11 years. And right now I'm the only one of our active judges that was a former trial court judge. And that's an important perspective when we're deliberating. You know, I can remember very clearly what it's like to have a courtroom full of people and trying to decide and try cases from that perspective. And, you know, one of our former judges, Spanish was her first language. Actually, one of our senior judges. And that brought a perspective to our deliberations, because we see many people with cases coming before our courts where maybe English is not their first language. And we do have former public defenders on our bench and former prosecutors. And when we are all together on a panel, that is an important interaction and discourse. And I also think racial diversity, gender diversity, ethnic diversity is critical. And when I guess what prompted me to write the article in 2010, gee, that's a long time ago, right? Was that there was not a lot of diversity among the state high courts and the federal courts of appeal. You tend to see, particularly with respect to Black women judges at that time, and I think it's still true, to see Black women judges as trial court judges or magistrate judges or hearing officers, which are very critical roles, all of which I've served in, because those are the sort of entry points to the court system for many parties, the first judicial officer they see. And so it's important to have diversity at that level, but we didn't seem to see the same level of diversity. And, you know, at the time I wrote the article in 2010, I could count on both hands the number of Black women on the state Supreme Courts, the highest courts of various states, and we have 50 states, but I could still count on one hand all the Black women judges who were serving at on those state highest courts and on the federal circuits combined. And so now I'm proud that there has been an increase in those numbers, even with a couple of Black women chief justices of state high courts. And I include the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, which, even though the district is not a state, is our highest local court.
Exactly. And, you know, related to those statistics, we were looking at, you named some of the highest courts in different states. We were looking at some of the statistics of federal appellate courts. And I think there's a total of 15 Black women at the federal level out of, I think, 926 positions. So, you know, you were looking at these numbers back in 2010, and unfortunately, not too much progress has been made, although we have, you know, a huge historic victory this year. And, you know, one thing you noted in your article was that it appeared when you were looking at the history of progress in these events, that it appeared that a lot of judicial firsts that appeared over time in history happened around the same time that there appeared to be environments that were conducive to a lot of these major changes. Like, for example, you know, the abolitionist movement, the Reconstruction era, the women's suffrage movement. So these progressive movements were occurring, and at around those same times is when we saw a lot of these judicial firsts. And now this year we see another huge judicial first, yep, with Justice Jackson on the U.S. Supreme Court. In your mind, do you see any notable conditions that you think contributed to an environment that allowed her to join the U.S. Supreme Court this year?
Well, I have to say how proud, what a proud moment it was for me personally, what a proud moment in this country's history to have, number one, so incredibly qualified and seasoned and brilliant legal mind and jurist, and then a beautiful Black woman judge who was proud and confident, yet humble and approachable. And so I was just so proud at how she conducted herself during a hearing process that was concerning at times, mm-hmm, where it didn't always seem that she was courted the respect that her accomplishments and experience deserved. But she persevered and she did an amazing job at the hearing. And, you know, this is an interesting time in our nation because on the one hand, you do have the appointment of the first African-American woman to the Supreme Court. And it sort of tracks what I noticed in my article when I started looking into historical trends. And this is where I think it begins to be difficult to talk about race. Sometimes what I know, race and gender and intersection and the intersection between the two, because what I looked at was the first in terms of judges on high courts, state high courts or state or federal circuit courts, were other than white men. Initially, all the judges were white men. And then after, I guess, in the early stages of the abolition movement, abolitionist movement, and especially right around early Reconstruction era. That's when we first see some diversity in the judiciary. And those first were Black men. In the aftermath of Reconstruction, the first diverse judges on courts were Black men. And women weren't there, white, Black, or and then we see, you know, in the early 1900s with the early women's suffrage movement, that's when we see the first women, white women, appointed to the judiciary. And it's not until much later, around the civil rights era in the late 60s, early 70s, that we begin to see the first Black women appointed to local or federal benches in any significant numbers. And I thought that was interesting because that seems to be a trend when you look at diversity in law firms. Initially, most of the law firms were white men, and then you began to see Black men, and then you began to see some women, white women initially, and then Black women. And so if we look at the Supreme Court, that's sort of been the pattern in terms of the first diverse appointments were Black men and then white women. We had Justice Sotomayor, and now Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. So I don't know why it follows that why it follows that pattern. And the last 2 years, 2.5 years in this country with what I like to call twin pandemics, the COVID-19 pandemic, which rocked the core of our souls. You know, we were personally impacted in this country, but also around the world. But we also saw a resurgence of racial unrest in this country like we haven't seen in decades, sort of coming to a head in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. And I think with those two things, COVID-19 pandemic followed closely on the heels by this tragic death of George Floyd, which we watched on television, we saw the exposure again of fault lines that have existed in this country along race, along poverty and income coming together in a way that hit the courts. We've seen it firsthand. I mean, it is, it's an issue that we need to grapple with, but I also think the opportunities that came out of both of those tragic pandemics, the aftermath of George Floyd, many of us began to refocus on having these difficult conversations about race. And that racism is not just a feeling. It is undergirded by legal discrimination and laws that allowed for legalized discrimination based on race in this country for many years. And I think that's something that we often forget. And that's why our courts are so important, to make sure we're being fair and that we are, even being well-intentioned, are not putting in place policies and procedures that have disparate impacts based on race. We learned in the aftermath of Ferguson, Missouri, that some of the laws, fines and fees that were being imposed on people with low incomes, those fines and fees doubling, causing them to be arrested and incarcerated. We learned that some of those practices and procedures, however well-intentioned they may have been, had a disparate impact on, based on race and income and poverty lines, and that created an injustice. And courts and judges, we don't like to think of ourselves as anything but fair and impartial. That's what we strive to be, and we do a good job. Our court system in this country is better than any that I've seen in the world, but we still have work to do. And I think we're good to the extent that we keep challenging ourselves to be better. And what I was proud of in the aftermath of George Floyd is that many chief judges around the country took sort of an unprecedented step of speaking out publicly about the role of the courts to uphold equal justice under law. And it, you know, it sounds like, well, why wouldn't judges be doing that all along? I think the view has been that, you know, judges are fair and impartial. We shouldn't step into the fray of public controversy. But my view, and the view of many chief justices at the time, was that if judges don't step up and speak about the importance of equal justice under law, you know, the words inscribed on the door above the United States Supreme Court, then who will? And so now we see more of these conversations about race. I have to use that word because those are hard conversations. We talked about implicit bias, but what we saw during the protests that erupted in the aftermath of George Floyd were protests around what was often expressed an explicit bias. And so we have to be able to have these conversations. And we've done it in our court. I've instituted a racial equity initiative for the DC courts. And we're diverse compared to many jurisdictions, but we still have to talk about it. And that helps us do better when we focus for the reasons that you all are focusing on diversity and inclusion. You know, why do we need it? It's not that we are saying someone else is bad because they are not diverse. Or when we talk about race, it's not that we're saying someone else is racist because they are a different race from me. But we're talking about recognizing that there was a time in this country's history where there was legalized discrimination based on race. And the vestiges of the law in some places, we still have to guard against having that creep back into our laws and our society.
You mentioned that the District of Columbia Court of Appeals is a rather diverse court. And I wanted to ask you, what have you seen over the years in terms of the diversity of that court? And how have you all, or what have you all been doing in order to cultivate that diversity? Because as you mentioned, we see that there are qualified diverse individuals or people of different backgrounds in this country that could serve in these positions. There have always been, they just have not had the opportunities for various reasons, including the ones that you just listed. And so we want to try to work as a country toward opening more doors so that we can have more diverse panels of judges. And what has the District of Columbia Court of Appeals done to address this issue? And what do you encourage other courts to do to work toward creating more diverse institutions?
I'm going to talk a little more broadly. I call it our District of Columbia Courts, and I include our trial court and our Court of Appeals. And in my role as Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, I also oversee our DC court system, which includes our trial court and our Court of Appeals and our support systems, the management structure. You know, the judiciary is an independent branch of government. So we have a personnel system, we have procurement, we have budget, we have finance, we have capital projects. So it is a branch of government. And I like to remind people, because we often don't get the same kind of civics that we used to get in Girl Scouts or in elementary school about the three co-equal branches of government. And I think first thing you have to do is value and appreciate that we serve a community that is diverse. And I think that's true for most communities. And the diversity looks differently in different communities, perhaps. But in the District of Columbia, we have rich diversity to draw from. We are the third largest bar in the country, despite our small geographic size in terms of numbers. We have some of the most excellent lawyers in private practice, in government service, in public interest work. And so we have a wealth of talent. And so we have to recognize the value of diversity in terms of the people we serve and how we serve them. And I think one of the things that we have to look at is how we define what qualified means. And I think when you have diverse voices at the table talking about the skills and the talents and the experiences that make someone a good judge, we have to open our minds a little more broadly. And I think sometimes I worry when I say that people might hear something that I'm not saying. I'm not saying that we have to lower the criteria, dumb down the profession. I'm saying that we have to expand our often narrow view about what makes someone a good lawyer or what makes someone a good judge. So I would start there. It's not just former prosecutors or former public defenders who've done criminal defense or criminal prosecution. It's private practitioners from large and small firms. It is people who've worked in public interest groups like legal aid. And so when you expand your view, you get wonderfully talented, committed, smart, brilliant jurist. The other thing is that the pool of people that we want to invite to consider a profession in the judiciary cannot self-select themselves out. I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to minority candidates at our many different diverse bars who say, I'm not ready. I couldn't do this. Really, me? And so you can't take yourself out of the game. You have to think of this as a noble, important, and much needed. We need you in the judiciary. And then I hear it a lot with law clerks, and Bahati will remember this from being in chambers. I have a wall of pictures of all my former law clerks, and I'm proud of the diversity of all of my law clerks. But it doesn't happen by accident. I try to be intentional because I don't want to work in an echo chamber with everybody just telling me what I want to hear or everyone who thinks just like I do. I want diverse viewpoints, life experiences, professional desires. And so I seek that out in my law clerks. Black, white, Asian, Hispanic, male, female, LGBTQ, old, young, out of law school, prior work experience, because that enriches me and helps me to be a better judge. I've actually seen some decreases in diversity on the bench. At one point, our Court of Appeals, we're 9 judges at full strength. We've had some persistent vacancies because our judges have to go through, have to be nominated by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. And there have been delays in that process for both federal judges and judges for our court. So we've had persistent vacancies. But at one point, early when I joined the court, we were at full strength, 9 judges. We had 5 women and 4 men. And we had 4 women of color. That's pretty good. And in my article, you'll see one of the first women on a state high court of appeals, African-American woman, was appointed by President Ford, I want to say, to our DC Court of Appeals. And that was in the early 70s, Julia Cooper Mack.
I just want to recap what you said, because I think it's so important, especially when you touched on expanding your view of what qualified means. I find that so often when that comes up, people think, oh, you're taking away things or lowering expectations or going outside of what. No, it's about just having a broader view. So I love the examples you gave, because that can give people different ideas and perspectives of, oh, most definitely someone who worked in public service could be an amazing judge and bring a different perspective to the judiciary if they did take on that role. So expanding the view of what is qualified, definitely don't cut yourself short. You know, we, especially women, there have been some studies about that, women, and particularly women of color with the imposter syndrome and otherwise not believing that they are qualified. You know, it's something I remember reading about women seeing 10 items on a post about this position. If they don't have one, they're like, I'm not qualified, you know, like if they're only missing one thing. So we have to get out of that as people of color to put our name out there and see what happens. And then third, being intentional. I think if the judges and others just are intentional and hold themselves accountable, we can definitely have great strides in increasing the level of diversity on courts, in law firms, in any places of employment, because when the intentionality is there, then the action happens. Because, you know, they say what gets measured get done. So if we're measuring it, it will get done and we'll start seeing these strides that we want to see. So I thank you so much for that. I think that was excellent pearls of wisdom.
You know, the other thing I would add about the intentionality piece is that I am very aware that I know I didn't get here by myself. I didn't just hatch as Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. I stand on the shoulders of so many people, starting with my parents who mentored me and believed in me and encouraged me. And I've had wonderful teachers and law professors and have had and still have wonderful mentors who have coached, mentored, pushed, pulled, encouraged me and believed that I could do it. And so another thing I think that happens sometimes is that we institutionally may say we're going to bring on and be more diverse and inclusive, and we bring in people, and then we don't give them the support that they need to succeed and achieve. And it takes active mentoring at all stages of our careers to grow and develop, and active coaching and sponsoring, I mean, to use a lot of words from the private sector. And the people who get that are not necessarily the ones who are the smartest or best qualified. They're the ones who get the mentoring and the sponsoring and the guiding and the opportunities. And we all need it. You know, the mentor grows as much as the mentee when you have those kinds of relationships. And sometimes it's hard for us to ask for help and to seek out help because we feel like it exposes a vulnerability. But it's in doing that and being vulnerable that you get the help and guidance that you often always need to succeed and grow professionally and personally too.
And you know, what you were just describing is the inclusion piece that people often miss. They get that representation, they get the diversity, but the inclusion, making that person feel welcomed, ensuring that they have the support that they need, following up and following through with them, encouraging them, being there, being a voice for them when they're out of the room, the sponsorship you're talking about, all those things helps. And it's so critically important.
I'll add, you know, I know we assume it, we presume it, but I'm going to say it, that you have to still come to the table with your sleeves up, ready to work hard and prepared to work hard. That means you've got to get the foundation. You can't fake it until somebody supports and sponsors you. You've got to come ready to work and with the tools that can then be further honed. I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I'm saying about, you know, you know how hard you work. As I look at both of you and as I talk to all the people who are out there, that you work hard. And sometimes it's tough love and tough feedback that we don't want to hear, but we need in order to grow. And we can't cringe and wilt when we get that tough feedback. We've got to have the grit to dig in harder, to correct when we get some feedback that warrants correction, and to keep moving forward. And I think sometimes, you know, we make a mistake and we just want to go hide our heads in the sand. I've had that experience. Like, I made one mistake, I'm a failure for life. Well, no, you're going to make mistakes. And we all make them. And so you've got to learn from them, pick yourself up, dust yourself off. And as my mom always used to tell me, fix your lipstick and keep moving.
Well, and I think that those are all incredibly, incredibly amazing pieces of wisdom and advice. And I also hope that we continue to see, you know, more people, you know, mentoring and sponsoring others, and more people receiving mentorship and receiving sponsorship. And I hope that we see that across racial lines, right? So I think there's also a lot of pressure for Black people to mentor Black people. But I think it's okay for you know, to have allies that are mentoring and sponsoring as well. And I hope that we see that those are that are listening, that we get that support across, you know, all racial lines, across all different backgrounds, that we're helping out each other so we can grow more diverse spaces, whether that's in law firms, whether that's in chambers, whether that's in judicial appellate spaces, whether that's, you know, trial courts, whether that's in public spaces, private, all the spaces. I think that it's important that we, if we're working to make spaces more diverse, that it has to be everybody working to do that, not just women, not just those who are part of the minority groups, but everybody has to have their hand in working toward that effort. And I hope everyone is listening to your words, Judge Blackburn Rigsby, because they are incredibly, incredibly important. And we thank you so much for joining us today. Your thoughts and your wisdom is just invaluable. And I'm blessed to have been a law clerk of yours. And I was so excited when you said that you were able to join us today, because I was excited for everyone to just hear from you. Thank you again for sharing so much of your pearls of wisdom with us today.
Well, my pleasure. And you're right. Mentors come in all shapes, sizes, colors, races. And I've had men, women, Black, white. You know, we it takes a village, and I try to pay it forward and to lift as I have climbed, because I'm passing the baton over to you all to keep keep it going and pass it forward. So pay it forward, as I say.
Absolutely, absolutely. So hopefully we will see more. We will see more Nkemelis in the future. We'll see more Judge Blackburn Rigsbys in the future. And we will see more Justice Ketanji Brown Jacksons in the future.
And more Bahatis.
Exactly. More Bahatis.
Thank you. Thank you again, Judge Blackburn Rigsby. And thank you all for listening to our episode. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.
Thank you for listening to Diversity Ever After, a Baker Donaldson D&I podcast. We hope that this conversation has made you feel more seen, valued, and empowered to become in touch, in tune, and inclusive in your day-to-day interactions. Remember that inclusion starts with I. Until next time, please like, comment, and share this episode.